Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, the American small farmer in peril. But first on today's show, workers on the food chain.
The killing floor at Smithfield Hams. A century ago almost, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle shocked the world about the atrocious conditions endured by workers in meatpacking plants. Time stands still at Smithfield. Renewing its efforts to organize workers at a Smithfield packing plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina, the United Food and Commercial Workers June 19th launched a nationwide community-based campaign against the meatpacker. Well, if you haven't read Upton Sinclair, what we're saying is that 100 years ago, when people were finding bits and pieces of the human anatomy in the meat that they ate because workers were not protected, well, that is still the case. And if you've tried a Smithfield ham recently, you've got a lot to learn this evening. And our guests?
Edward Morrison, fired Smithfield worker, Lenora Bailey, a fired worker at Smithfield, and Jean Bruskin, director of the Smithfield Justice Campaign, United Food and Commercial Workers Union.
Fired workers? My goodness. What actually is going on? I've always been thrilled when somebody has brought me back from the South a Smithfield ham. I happen to love ham. And Smithfield has long been noted as one of the major hams, and people get great joy they're brought back for special holidays and stuff. So, what's going on at Smithfield? Why do we have fired workers? And what's wrong with the meatpacking industry there? And maybe we can start with our two fired workers, Edward.
Well, in my situation, I was injured and fired, but I'm just one of many cases. What Smithfield does is, if you can't push that hog out the door for them anymore, then they don't need your services. And with the North Carolina laws, they just can fire you at will, and they do.
Edward, tell us more about what happened in your case, the conditions you worked under, and what happened when you got injured.
In my situation, I was on what you call the GAM table, which is in the wet kill side of the kill floor. What we do is we hang the hogs after they're killed. Once they're killed, they go through a boiler with some boiling water, and then they come to this machine called a shaving machine, a dehair machine. And when the hog shoots out of that machine, it shoots on a rolling table, and I'm at the end of that machine waiting on the hog to come out, and I grab him by his back leg and flip him over to his right side, and then the cutters that are next to me cut him, and the guy on the end of the table, he hangs him. And we do about, in less than eight-hour shift, really about 7 3/4 hours or less, we flip 4,000 hogs apiece, which is a total of 16,000 hogs because we have four flippers. And in my case, I would flip for 30 minutes and then go on the floor for 30 minutes. And whatever falls off of the table, which something always does, you go on the floor and you pick it up. And while I was pushing them back towards the line, I tore a meniscus in my knee and I had to have surgery. They put me on medical leave and sent me a certified letter in the mail telling me if I couldn't return to work 100% by November the 2nd. 2005, I was fired. And of course, I had just had my surgery 3 weeks before that, so there was no way I was going to be able to return to work. And they fired me, and I was out of work for almost 3 months with no income because I couldn't draw unemployment because I couldn't work. I was there almost 6 months before my injury. My work I did was very hot temperatures. We worked around two big fires boiling water. It was during the summer months of last year, and you stayed dehydrated and exhausted, and your muscles would lock up. And you'd have to go home and sleep it off before you could even take a shower. You would be so tired. The line speeds were just unbearable, but we had to do it because we were always short on workers. People would quit. They wouldn't last 15 minutes. We had one guy come in, and 10 minutes later, he walked out the door. Had another guy come in, and he was gone by lunchtime, so we had to pick up his slack. So you always wanted your fellow worker to show up for work, because if he didn't, your job was going to be that much harder for that day.
And what was the pay rate?
When I started, I was making $8.10 an hour. And after I got to my top pay, they called it, I was making $11.85, which I thought was underpay for me for that job.
So why were you fired? You sound, I heard about the knee, but you sound pretty dedicated, pretty committed to the work, regardless of the harsh conditions. But this was just, you got hurt and that was going to be the end of it?
Yes, because I couldn't push the hogs anymore. They want you to work. They got orders to fill, and it's all about that hog. You don't matter. Because when they denied me my workman's comp, they didn't pay for my surgery. I had to pay for it out of my insurance, which I'm still paying.
That's what I wanted to get at. So no workers' comp, nothing.
No, they told me that what happened to me was not an accident. Even though it happened on the job, they have a policy that says if you don't slip, trip, or fall, that you are not eligible for a workman's comp. So they denied me, and to this day, they still deny me.
Gene Groshkin, how similar is that situation to other people? Is this a unique situation that Edward is describing here about the pace of work and injuries?
Unfortunately, it's pretty routine. They do 32,000 hogs in two shifts at the plant. So that means 16,000 a shift, 2,000 an hour. They run every few seconds. And Edward had a particular job on there where he actually, some people are doing the cuts of various kinds. Edward actually had to move and shift the hog around. So he was lifting all 300 pounds or so of it. But all the jobs are really difficult. But what it makes them impossible is that the speed is so fast that you just can't keep up. However, we have got a worker center down there at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. We have a worker center, and we find on a daily basis people come in, tell us this story, how they got hurt on the job. When they asked for workers' comp, they were told basically that they couldn't prove that it was done on the job, and when the worker pushed for it, they were fired. So then you've got no medical insurance, you've got no job, and you're permanently disabled. The whole area down there is like the walking wounded because so many people have come through the plant. You know, the turnover is easily 50%. When you have 6,000, 5,000 to 6,000 over a period of years, we're talking about thousands of people, and they're all going to the county medical clinics trying to get taken care of. It's just criminal what Smithfield is doing.
Well, before we get back to the overall campaign that's being launched and some of the issues of the National Labor Relations Board and the D.C. Court of Appeals, we do want to bring Lenora, who has joined us, into the discussion and find out what her experience was at Smithfield. Lenora, how long had you worked with Smithfield, and what was your experience there?
I worked there 2.5 years, and they didn't know how to treat their people. I got hurt, tenderized in the hand, and I was on the doctor's care for a while. Then I got sick and had to have surgery, and I was going to doctor, had my doctor's excuse, and they terminated me. They don't like for us to work together, you know. They curse you out, and there's a lot of sexual harassment there and stuff. And once they terminate you with your insurance automatically goes, and there you left with not being able to pay your doctor's bill and stuff. And they don't give you a chance to work, to do your job. They're always harassing you. It's just a mess.
Now, you said they're always harassing you. How many workers were on your floor? We heard some of the experiences that Edward had. More specifically, what about yourself? I mean,
I worked in the coal, and sometimes the boxes weighed over 70 pounds or more. It was very cold. You worked in there with snow suits and on. We had about maybe 10 or 15 people on that line trying to pack a bunch of meat just going through, and they want you to keep up with the different packs of meat, the labors and all that. And if someone tried to help you out when you got behind, they would say, no, you do your job what I told you to do and let them do their job. They didn't want us to work together.
So, Gene, let's go to looking at the question of the plant in Tar Heel and the campaign of the United Food and Commercial Workers, which began on June 19th.
Well, I think it helps for people to have a little bit of history, which is that plant opened in the early 90s and people tried to organize right away. And in 94, they had an election close. Company was found that violated the NLRB. They made a deal with the union, actually signed a letter promising to do the right thing, and held another election in 97. And at that election was where the companies totally lost it. And the actually assaulted the committee at the spot of the election, where the NLRB was right there. And the board found them, have used threats, intimidation, violence, racial epithets, assaults, threatening workers with deportation, unlawfully firing and intimidating workers. It's like, if you ever see the NLRB decision, it goes on and on. However, the board didn't really enforce that, and so the company continued to do this kind of stuff really ever since then, and they get away with murder on the floor and other subsequent activities by people trying to organize the company has also been found to having assaulted them, fired them, and so on. So after, really from the union's point of view, exhausting every possible reasonable attempt to get the law to work for the union. Unions decided that the law isn't going to work, mostly because the company doesn't respect it, and has begun to do a national campaign wherever product is sold out of that plant, which is primarily east of the Mississippi, to educate the consumers about the conditions down in Tar Heel. That's what we did the week of the 19th. We were in New York and Chicago and Boston, seven cities altogether, Atlanta, Raleigh, Richmond, and basically telling people that there's blood on that bacon, you know, that ham, that lean generation, that Smithfield pork is made under absolutely brutal conditions, and calling on people to tell the company that it's unacceptable. And I'd like to say right now that if anybody wants to, you could actually call the CEO of the company. His name's Joe Luter, L-U-T-E-R, and he's got a phone, 888-366-6767. And we want people to call him up and say that it's got to stop.
I just want to ask, is that a Tar Heel bird that we hear singing in the background? Which one of you has a beautiful bird?
Those are my birds.
They're wonderful.
Well, they've gone national. Ed, you went national recently. Lenora and Edward, you were both on a tour speaking about Smithfield around the country. Why don't you tell us where you were and what you said and who you were speaking with?
I went to Washington, D.C. to the kickoff of the national campaign. And it went really well. I spoke about my situation at Smithfield, as well as other workers from the plant. We had some Latin workers, some Latino workers, and they spoke also. And it went really well. We had the Reverend Hagler there, and he spoke, and he put some action in motion, and it went really well. It was really nice. We were in the streets, we were protesting, we were rallying, and I enjoyed it. And it's just the beginning, about to come.
And Reverend Hagler has played a major role in so many important and progressive activities over an extended time in Washington, D.C., so that's a great ally to have.
Reverend Hagler, by the way, while he was down speaking to preachers in the area around the plant, called up the plant and said he wanted to see it, and they let him in. And they spent a long time trying to convince him that they were on the side of the angels and the workers weren't, but they failed. So Reverend Hagler is actually one of the few people in this campaign who's had an opportunity to walk through and see how bad it is.
And Lenora, you were on this on different...
Yes, I went to New York and to Boston, and it was very experiencing challenge. We got to talk to Reverend Jeffrey. He was helping us, and a lot of other news reporters was there, and they were photographing, and we also did a campaign, and we marched, and we was trying to let people know that we were united, that we were wanting asking folks to speak up for us because, well, the people there and me, myself, when I was there, we were afraid to talk because we would lose our job. And when they was trying to get the union when I was there, they would tell us that if we signed the papers, we would be terminated. So that was an opportunity then to let the people know that we are behind you now. We have someone that's helping us or trying to help us, going to help us to speak out so that we won't be afraid to lose our job. And when we get sick, there's someone that has our back to say, you will still have a job when you come back, but you won't have to worry about being terminated because you were sick or you got hurt on the job. Your job is still going to be there waiting on you. And I think especially the SEIU 1199 for their support, especially the news people there from New York, they were very supportive in letting us know that they had our back and that they was going to stand for us. And today we give our thanks to them and to Reverend to Gene and those that's out there trying to fight for us, which we were afraid to do for ourselves.
Gene, tell us something about the ownership of the company.
This is a $11 billion publicly traded company. It's on the stock exchange. You know, it's got a wide range of owners. It's run by this guy named Joe Luter, who made close to $11 million last year. He's just decided to step down as CEO, still going to be the chairman of the board, his son, you know, moving up the ranks. Interestingly enough, this company has grown by acquisition, and so it owns union companies all over the country where it bought them union and kept them union. In other parts of it, particularly like in the Midwest, so brands like Farmland and Patrick Cudahy and other kinds of products, they've seen that they can actually have a union and make some money, but in this case, they've been unwilling to. In Europe, they have $1 billion worth of investment. They're fast becoming the biggest pork company in Europe, and they go union there. Even in, although many of their employees in North Carolina are Mexican, and they threaten to deport them when they try to organize, in Mexico, the workers at the Smithfield plant have a union. So it's an attempt of Smithfield and other packing employers to use North Carolina as an opportunity to just line their pockets at exorbitant rates, and it's unconscionable.
And Edward, you're fired, but you're still working on the campaign. What do you want to tell the folks out there about Smithfield, and should they be buying Smithfield hams?
No, I wouldn't say buy Smithfield hams. I'd say find an alternative if you can. And also to log on to the Smithfield for Justice campaign, the changetowin.com. Pick up your newspaper, follow the news, get involved, because this is happening to a lot of people, and all we want to do is make sure that the workers are treated fairly, have a say, get better pay, better benefits, and better treatment, and just to pay attention.
Lenora, similarly, you continue to organize. Is the community sympathetic with the efforts that you and Edward and the United Food and Commercial Workers are going through to really see that the conditions are significantly improved in the Smithfield industries?
Yes, I think they are. And I think the more we are out there speaking up now, because like I said, once we were afraid to speak up, we're getting more input and, you know, more people sympathetic and saying, yes, we want to help. Whatever we can do, just let us know so that we can help you.
And Gene, we've got a minute left and it's yours.
Well, I'll just say that the way this is going to be won is, in addition to the workers organizing on the ground down there, it's people, places like New York, getting involved. And the easiest way to get involved is to go to our website, www.smithfieldjustice.com. You can sign in, you can read stuff, and we will hook you up with people locally that are doing, there's an ongoing coalition forming there. Give Joe Luter a call at 888-366-6767.
Oh, give us that number one more time, because I think we want to make some phone calls tomorrow.
Joe Luter, 888-366-6767.
And what are we going to tell them?
Well, I think tell them that that you heard about the mistreatment going on inside of his plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina, and that's a disgrace, and it's a disgrace in your community that products coming out of this plant are being sold that were made under those conditions, and you want it to stop. We're talking Smithfield ham, Smithfield pork, Smithfield bacon. Almost any of the products that say Smithfield on it came out of this plant.
And we're talking about 5,500 workers in Tar Heel, North Carolina. Well, this is a good time to think vegetables, quite literally. And because we're going to tell Smithfield we are not going to eat their products until the conditions of the workers improve. And in case you think we don't get a lot of authenticity here, we had our singing birds all the way down from Tar Heel, North Carolina. So, Lenora, we thank you for bringing on our sweet-sounding friends from down there.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
And Edward Morrison, we're going to keep on top of this issue. It is of grave importance. Yes, 100 years have passed, and we're still looking at the situation that was first brought forth by Upton Sinclair in the jungle, and enough is enough is enough. Special thanks to Gene Brushkin, director of the Smithfield Justice Campaign of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Again, Lenora, Edward, we thank you for joining us on Building Bridges. We're not eating any pork products.
Thank you.
Until the situation improves.
Yeah, we can eat it if it's not Smithfield.
Yeah.
You go overboard, Dick.
Well,
Dick,
thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a blessed day.
This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Was a great high wall there that tried to stop me, and a great big sign that said private property. On the other side, it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me. In the city square,
shadow of the steeple. By the relief office, I saw my people. I just stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me?
This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
And continuing our broadcasting on this show, Workers on the Food Chain, family farmers and farm workers are working for fair prices for their commodities and fair wages. They're promoting changes to U.S. farm and food policy while forging regional and international campaigns to promote food sovereignty. And now George Naylor, Iowa corn farmer and president of National Family Farm Coalition.
I think I have to represent some ideas here to dispel some of the myths that are perpetuated by what we have as company unions. Farm organizations like the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Pork Producers Council and the National Corn Growers Association, etc., that farmers are just doing great in the United States and that everybody should just eat, drink, and be merry. But the reality is that family farmers have been disappearing from this country for many years. In particular, since after World War II, when the giant agribusiness gained political power and decided that we didn't nearly need family farmers, the most important thing would be to have cheap farm commodities, number one, and a second benefit for them from that was to drive farmers off of the land so that they could become cheap labor in our cities. And now this system has become an international attitude of driving farmers off of their land all over the world and letting them become cheap labor in the manufacturing plants of Nike and Levi's and Texas Instruments, etc. Okay, the fundamental economic reason and the way they can do this is not by any conspiracy or the need to impose an economic crisis on farmers. It just is the matter of the way the market works in agriculture as in labor. When there is too many agricultural products, according to big business, or too much labor, according to big business, there is a natural economic downward pressure on the price of agricultural products and labor, which both benefit big corporations. And the intention of the WTO in liberalizing trade is to make the market supreme, to let the power of the market rule our lives, and to deny us the democratic institutions and ability to make the laws such that we are guaranteed a fair wage, a minimum wage, that or a living wage on the one hand, or fair prices to make sure that farmers are secure on their land and can take care of their land and take care of their family and contribute to their community in the way that they should. So our only recourse is to regain our democracy, not only in our own countries, but worldwide, to not let the WTO impose the market on our lives. And luckily, we have many allies around the world in terms of farmers and peasants in other countries. And luckily, they often are much more organized and have much more confidence in their ability to influence the future world events than we farmers here in the United States. And then we have our allies in labor, and we're very closely aligned, and I hope we can develop those relationships even stronger. And our message as members of Via Campesina is that we would like members of the labor movement to be supportive of this concept of food sovereignty, where after all, every country needs to have its own policy, its own food and agricultural policy, through democratic decision making, so that we have an agriculture that reflects our values, our culture, the need to protect our environment, and to have family farm agriculture that serves all of our interests versus multinational corporations who would just as soon have cheap agricultural products, cheap labor, and let the rest of society worry about the consequences of that. So food sovereignty, I think, is the message that we bring to the labor movement from the movement of family farmers and farm workers and peasants in the world. And I guess I would like to say that the message we want to give to everybody here and the rest of the world is that, I don't know, you remember, I'm way out of my league here when I'm talking about literature now, but you know the book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it says, you know, don't mourn for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for you. Thanks.
You've been listening to George Naylor, one of many farmers from around the world, who spoke at a conference, Food Chains, Workers and Farmers versus Free Trade, sponsored by Cornell's Global Labor Institute recently in New York City, and recorded by WBAI reporter Fred Gwynn.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And if you'd like to get in touch with Building Bridges, you can write Mimi, that's M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. Ken and I would love to hear from you.
For you and me.